We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm so happy to be joined once again by Wells King over at American Compass. Wells, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, last time we talked to Wells, it was about his excellent article on NASCAR and globalization. But this time, I mean, let me just start by saying one thing I really love about Wells's work is that it's both specific and broad at the same time. Specific in the sense that he dives into maybe these sort of niche corners of the economy, but those corners are the ones that tell us or represent broader truths. And the way in which, or as the sort of Randian capitalists have kind of seized control of the tech narrative over the course of the last couple of decades, I think we've really lost some important stories. And I want to talk about an excellent article that Wells wrote about the American Camry. There's just so much to discuss and on some of these questions about globalization, the American economy, American workers, and what can be done, what can be learned from the past. But Wells, let's start right here on your new article for the American Conservative about industrial policy and technology. It is just such an excellent piece. I encourage everybody to read it. So we'll break it down a little bit, but Wells, why don't you start just by giving us the broad argument of the article, and then we'll sort of pick it apart from there.
Yeah, sure. So in Silicon Valley and really in kind of in popular culture, we have this kind of myth about Silicon Valley. We think of it as sort of like the cradle of American prosperity and innovation, right? And we think that the sort of secret of Silicon Valley is that we just sort of have these geniuses with their laptops who congregate in garages and come up with the next big thing. And then if you flood, you know, billions of dollars of private capital in there to fund their great thoughts, that we hit this incredible prosperous software industry and America becomes sort of the leading innovator in the world. This is the narrative we like to tell ourselves. It's the narrative that's portrayed in, you know, HBO's Silicon Valley and lampooned, I think, rightly as well. Mm-hmm. But there's this sense as well in Washington that listeners may pick up on in the way that it's presented in some reports. But there's a real deference that Washington has to Silicon Valley. There is a sense that these tech bros are real geniuses, and that the only thing Washington can do, the best thing Washington can do, if it wants to create genuine American prosperity and innovation, is get out of the way and leave them to it. And that we can, can actively deregulate financial markets, keep government out of the way, and leave innovation to the geniuses of Silicon Valley and the self-regulating market, and all will be well. So there's slogans like, you know, permissionless innovation and others that you kind of hear sort of thrown around in the libertarian policy world in Washington. But this is the basic sense that you have. And look, like all myths, there's are certain elements of truth to it. But this kind of this myth of the Valley is like a libertarian paradise of tech geniuses is, at the end of the day, when you look at the lessons of history, it's really wrong, especially the policy implications that come out of it. Because when you go back through the record, and when you go back through the last nearly 100 years of history in Silicon Valley, what you find is that the federal government plays a limited but really important role in seeding innovation, scaling it, and commercializing it as well in ways that not only benefit the United States, but American workers and their families too. And in the decades when we've moved away from that more active government approach towards more of a hands-off approach is when we've seen offshoring and stagnating American innovation. And so this is not the time for Washington to be playing deference to Silicon Valley. It's time for Washington to step up.
Okay, Wells, you just said something I think that's really important. You said there were cases where there were small but critical interventions on behalf of the government or taken on behalf of the government in order to shepherd some of this innovative technology across the finish line or to a place where it could really make a difference. And you get the snowball kind of rolling down the hill. And the reason I think that's important is because it doesn't negate the role that free markets play here. It doesn't negate the role that competition and an environment that's conducive to entrepreneurship plays here. I just can't emphasize enough how important that is. But I think what you do so well is find places where the example is that there's a good balance, or you find good examples of where the government and the business community sort of struck a healthy balance and one that maybe we forget sometimes. And what are some of the examples? You walk through them in the piece, but what are some of the examples where we see this illustrated best?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, no one's going to say that you can have a truly innovative United States without the genius of the American people and the grit of its entrepreneurs. You have to have that. No one's denying that. But that alone isn't enough, and it hasn't historically been enough, especially when investors are reluctant to invest in the riskiest, most cutting-edge technologies that maybe they don't see the commercial potential of, or when there's no customer, say, but the Pentagon for some of these technologies. So absolutely, it's not one or the other. It has to be both. And historically, the Valley was humming. It really what was doing best when you had this kind of a symbiosis of, you know, private pursuit of profit with a public pursuit of the common good. And there was an understanding that there were certain national interests that needed to be met, in particular during the Cold War, trying to win the space race and beat communism in the Soviet era. But also a sense that, you know, that Silicon Valley did attract true American geniuses, in large part because of Stanford University and some other things. But again, it was about that symbiosis, bringing the two together and understanding that working together, technologists in Silicon Valley and policymakers in Washington could really make America an engine of prosperity and innovation.
And what are some of the examples? You kind of walk through a couple in the piece. What are some of the examples that stand out where we see this illustrated best?
Yeah, so I think there are kind of three broadly that I think each tend to emphasize the different roles that government played. The first was there's this right after the Sputnik launch. There was this great panic that we were losing and falling behind in innovation. And so President Eisenhower created the Advanced Research Projects agency, or ARPA, which eventually became DARPA, for defense projects. And what ARPA did, its role really cannot be overstated. ARPA set up research hubs and various academies throughout the United States, funded aggressive research projects, built up a proto-internet to coordinate those projects, including developing email, file transfers, and so on to coordinate research, and then had its own technologists and scientists advising, like the government scientists advising private innovators on how best to develop their own technologies. So it was writing, you know, these large strategic grants to researchers throughout the country, many of them in the academy, some in private industry, aimed at cutting edge technologies. It was an independent agency tasked with sort of blue sky thinking. And so, I mean, we really can credit ARPA with, you know, the development of the personal computer, of email, of even the internet. So many of the technologies that we take for granted today in the digital age, especially the hardware technologies, we can credit to a government agency based in the Pentagon that President Eisenhower put together with the goal of trying to beat the Soviets in the space race, but that created so much more, that had so much more potential within the private market. So that's the first, is government is kind of, you know, funding research innovation. The second, and this is really important in the history of the Valley, is government is kind of a collaborative first customer. So right after World War II, you know, we've entered the Cold War, right? We're trying to take on the Soviets. And we have all this incredible sort of early computing technology that had been developed in World War II. And a lot of it was based in Silicon Valley, which wasn't called Silicon Valley at the time, but just was Santa Clara County with Stanford University. And it eventually became a hub for developing semiconductor chips. And the reason Silicon Valley became a hub of semiconductor chips is because the Pentagon and the Air Force and NASA signed massive contracts with semiconductor innovators and developers in the Valley. In fact, the only reason we call it Silicon Valley and not Germanium Valley is because the needs of the Air Force and its bombers required silicon, which could withstand the extremely high temperatures and pressures that these chips needed to withstand. And the sort of the preferred materials to that point could not withstand the pressures of military applications. And so the government was really involved not only in signing these contracts. NASA alone, I think, was responsible for like 60% of integrated circuits in the 60s. I mean, it really was the only customer in town, but also in shaping the core design of a lot of these early stage technologies that now power, you know, virtually all devices that we use today. And then the third, and this is a limited role that I briefly describe in the piece, but it is important, is the work that government did to kind of prepare the soil for venture capital. Venture capital did not exist basically until the late 1970s. It was a very small, almost cottage industry. But government wanted private capital to take up funding early stage technologies and companies. And so what it did was created a program through the Small Business Administration, which did 2-to-1 matching for venture capital. So we aggressively subsidized venture capital beginning in the 1950s through the 70s. And then pursued a number of regulatory reforms in the late 70s and 80s that allowed venture capital to ultimately blossom and begin to fund a lot of these startups. And so even what we, I think, now today just assume to be the principal funder of technologies in the United States was itself kind of a creation of public policy. And so at basically every stage, from research and design to development and product design, to funding and financing, government played a constructive, albeit limited role. And so in all, so many respects, Silicon Valley and the digital economy that we have today is a product of public policy.
You said something important again, which is that the government for some of these products was basically the only customer in town. And I want to ask again, but this time sort of from the market perspective. Maybe this was in they're good examples from the 50s. Maybe it's the 90s of what in the market was driving some of these, you know, profit motivated innovations and then explosions in companies from that perspective, as opposed to, you know, perspective where the government really is in so many instances the only customer in town, as you highlight. What's going on in the market? What's going on in the marketplace that is motivating some of these huge leaps forward in tech?
So in so many cases, these early entrepreneurs were former academic researchers that had received government funding, government grants in their research that eventually they were able to find some kind of commercial application for. And then they signed on to government procurement contracts to provide those. And so in sort of the Valley's earliest days, right, so much of it's centered around Stanford University and a particular center they had that was headed up by some researchers from MIT that had been doing work in radios during World War II. And you had in entrepreneurs like David Packard, William Hewlett in the early days, these were also former academics as well. And they kind of were able to expand from sort of the garage into a full-fledged company by filling military contracts. They both received, you know, an Army-Navy E Award for their excellence in wartime production. And so, yeah, you absolutely cannot ignore the role of entrepreneurs. They were the ones that were actually setting these things up, building them, developing and designing them. But they had help from Uncle Sam along the way. And the help was often in the form of funding. When either they couldn't secure private funding themselves, or when private investors saw these things as being too high risk or not having immediate commercial application. Again, there was no computer industry at this time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. There weren't personal computers. And so really the only immediate applications you had for these technologies was the military. And so the role of government was typically to provide funding, of course, to R&D, and then eventually through procurement contracts as a customer.
Well, I want to transition into talking about how past may be prologue here. I know you and I, Wells, have talked about the CHIPS bill, a great example, you know, where we're in a clearly a very precarious situation when it comes to national security on several fronts, when it comes to even the American workforce on several fronts. So where is it? You know, where are there examples, or where are there areas right now where past could be prologue in some really powerful ways?
So CHIPS is a great example of a lot of the necessary work that's going to be that policymakers will have to do to bring innovation and production back to the United States. And really, I think the core theme for us should be beyond just sort of targeting sectors with important national security implications. It's really trying to undo this design here, build their business model that Silicon Valley has taken up, right? The idea that, you know, that on our iPhones, it says designed by Apple in California, but we know it's made in China by workers that are exploited and taken advantage of. And we don't even have the capabilities to build these iPhones here in the United States. In so many respects, I think it's about taking on that business model and understanding, as we used to, that production and innovation are really intimately related. You can only do so much in advancing product design and innovation without also trying to innovate within how you produce those products. The two are very, very closely related, especially in high-end, sophisticated manufacturing techniques. And so chips are a perfect example of this. We used to make semiconductor chips in the United States. We used to be the leaders in them. And we've since offshored so much of the fabrication of these chips, such that we began by offshoring production, thinking we can continue to maintain the lead in semiconductor design, even if we produce them overseas. And countries, mostly in East Asia, were smart and realized that, sure, that they could take on the fabrication of these chips. But in the process, they would develop skills and know-how and expertise about how these chips were produced. Again, this is extremely sophisticated, high-precision manufacturing, such that they would be able to also design better chips. And so now the U.S. and its sort of national champion within semiconductors, Intel, is no longer the world leader in semiconductor innovation. They no longer are able to build the most efficient chips. That goes to TSMC in Taiwan. And so really trying to ensure that we are not only designing here, but building here, I think will be the big goal. And, you know, CHIPS was an important but really imperfect bill, but that kind of approach will be necessary going forward, especially in core industries where, you know, historically the lesson is that if you want to produce it here, you have to subsidize, and CHIPS is the perfect example of that.
Well, I want to transition again, but this time to the American Camry, which is a fascinating article that Wells wrote for National Review. So if you still have your, I think it was an October edition, if you still have your stack of October National Reviews, you can go back and read the American Camry. I'm sure it's online as well. A great look back at a Reagan-era policy that is so similar in many ways to what we've now been talking about when it comes to Silicon Valley and those storied garages. There is a lot that we can learn. Of course, it's different in many key ways as well, but But if we could start, Wells, again, just by you breaking down the basic contours of the argument that you make in American Camry, that would be great. Similar to the conversation we've been having the second half of this episode, where would you say, Wells, there are areas in our economy right now where the lessons of the American Camry are sort of best applied? I imagine maybe you talk about chips again. I know there are a lot of different places. I can think of some just off the top of my head, but as somebody who follows these policy conversations so closely and studies them so closely and works on them so closely, what are those areas as you see them that where the lessons of the American Camry can sort of immediately or should sort of immediately be applied?
Yeah, so there's so much that can be said about the American auto industry and the turmoil that it's been in the last few decades. But I think this particular chapter is really interesting, not only because the economic conditions are so similar to our own, but also because I think the lessons that Ronald Reagan shows are just so applicable to today. And so the story goes something like this. The year is 1980, and economic conditions are not entirely unlike our own. You have very high gas prices, largely due to geopolitical disruptions. In our case, of course, today, it's Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Then it was the Iranian Revolution in spring of 1979. You have high inflation and a very unpopular Democrat in the White House. Because of high gas prices, American consumers were turning away from the specialty of American automakers at the time, larger sedans, larger vehicles, towards smaller, more efficient, more fuel efficient compact cars. These were the specialty of the Japanese, who at the time were the real rising power in the Asia Pacific. They were the geo-economic rival that the United States was confronting, and we were afraid we were going to be overtaken by. Japan had nurtured for decades after World War II its auto industry. It had aggressive state subsidy. It had aggressive tariff barriers, high protection, such that they essentially had dominance of their home market with a lot of government coordination and support. And what this produced were not only super high quality cars, some of the highest quality in the world. They were racking up all of the engineering design awards at the time and surpassing American firms in that respect, but also had the most efficient production and management techniques. I mean, Toyota, its management and production were like the envy of the world. And so the United States was really vulnerable to this. And so the big three American automakers, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, were all in peril. They had experienced a couple decades of sustained profits. They suddenly were experiencing losses. Chrysler was on the verge of bankruptcy, and the auto industry in the United States had to lay off a tenth of its workforce. The industry wanted support from Washington. Both Ford and the UAW applied for relief from the USITC, which rejected their petition and said, "I'm sorry, but if we offer import relief to you, we're afraid the Japanese won't want to invest in the United States." And the White House wasn't interested in helping either. So Jimmy Carter kind of essentially adopted a program of palliative care. He said, "Sure, we'll offer retraining to workers and maybe some support for communities that are affected, but we aren't going to provide any kind of import relief or a quota or anything to stop this." If there had been a software industry at the time, he would have told them to learn to code. There was no policy support whatsoever at the time. But of course, it was 1980, and there was a presidential election, and Ronald Reagan was running. And Ronald Reagan knew better than Jimmy Carter. And in October of 1980, he goes to a Chrysler plant in Michigan, and he promises protectionism. He says, if Japan does not change its approach, there's going to be what you call protectionism. We will provide relief to American workers in the American auto industry. And so, of course, Reagan gets elected in 1980, big landslide victory. And immediately in 1981, as soon as he's sworn into office, there's this big debate internally in the White House about what to do about it. You kind of have, similar to, I think, the way you have on the right of center today, you have kind of sort of a free market faction, you know, sort of the disciples of Hayek and free markets. and more of like a pragmatist wing, those that have experience in industry and in labor. And these two wings were really duking it out. You had the free market faction led by Donald Regan, a former Merrill Lynch executive, Treasury Secretary, who was saying, no, we can't provide any kind of import relief or protectionism. If we do this, it will insulate our domestic producers from competition. They won't have an incentive to innovate. And market theory holds that you want to have as much competition as possible to ensure the innovation takes place. Plus, we don't want to increase prices for consumers. For the pragmatist wing, they say, no, Mr. President, we have to do something. Our industry needs breathing room. And yes, this may modestly raise prices for American consumers, but the benefits will be tremendous in the long run, and it'll pay off ultimately, not only for American producers, but for American workers. So President Reagan weighs these things, and I think understands that in many respects, this entire situation defied free market theory. And according to market theory, right, a protectionist power like Japan should not have the most innovative companies in the world. It should not be producing cars more efficiently than ours. And our approach, the American approach at the time of free trade, open competition, should have produced the most efficient outcomes. And it should have led to prosperity for all Americans. And of course, it wasn't. The industry was suffering. And so in many ways, it was sort of the situation's defiance of free market theory that led Reagan to adopt a program of what I like to call economic statesmanship. He understood that the situation, particular situations demand a particular response that often deviates from dogma and actually responds to practical circumstances as they are. And so what he did was he negotiated essentially a quota. They called it the voluntary export restraints, which is to say, he went to the Japanese and negotiated a limit on their auto exports to the United States and capped it at the level of 1979. It was like 1.7 million cars, and said, you cannot import more cars than this to the United States. He did that. He set up a quota. And the outcomes were pretty surprising, at least to the free market folks. Given breathing room, American automakers not only were able to stabilize their market share, but were actually able to improve their competitiveness. They adopted more efficient strategies. Their manufacturing techniques improved. They launched some joint ventures with Toyota to improve their management style and approach. And they were winning design awards again. But the most probably surprising and lasting effect was that, contra what the USITC had declared, that protectionism would prevent the Japanese from investing in the United States, it actually spurred this entire wave of investment, which we still benefit from today. In 1980, there were zero Japanese automakers with any kind of production or assembly facilities in the United States. By the end of the decade, every single major Japanese automaker, all eight, had assembly facilities in the United States, mostly in the Midwest and the American South. And it was because the type of quota that Ronald Reagan negotiated only applied to cars that were imported from Japan, not those that were assembled in the United States. And this is why, if you drive through much of the American South or even the Midwest, and you'll see, Toyota plants, Volkswagen plants, Subaru plants, foreign automakers now assemble and produce cars here. They also do R&D here as well, in large part because Ronald Reagan set up a set of incentives for them to want to begin to invest in the United States. And this is why our Camrys are made not in Japan, but in Kentucky.
Did you get much pushback on this piece at all?
It got so much pushback. It's amazing.
I saw Lynn Saccombe weighing in on that. Am I remembering correctly?
The libertarians in Washington were self-immolating. It was amazing.
Okay, so tell me about, especially since you published in one of their precious spaces, National Review, tell me, Wells, about how they countered the sort of Reagan example. Were they arguing that Reagan's policy was bad or a failure, or that it was different from some of the decisions that kind of new right folks might pursue now?
Yeah, so their argument was that it was a failure. And their argument basically had two prongs to it. One said that, look, this raised prices for consumers and therefore was a horrible, horrible decision. The second was, they said, the Japanese would have invested anyways look at all the investments that they made in the 1990s once the quota had been lifted. That was the essence of their arguments. Both are candidly completely false. First, yes, this modestly raised prices for consumers. It raised them by about 8%. We already were experiencing dramatic inflation at the time. And so a lot of the increase in prices can be attributed to that. On top of that, however, the American people had already expressed a willingness to play slightly higher prices for American-made goods, especially if it was going to protect American jobs. There was a New York Times poll from like 1980, I believe, that showed that roughly 70% of Americans agreed they were willing to pay a slightly higher price if it protected American jobs, which this policy did. And so as a political decision, lower consumer prices is not always the standard, contra what the libertarians may claim. The second is that, yes, it's absolutely true that the Japanese began investing in production facilities in the 1990s in the United States. But that was only because they had assembly plants in the 1980s that Ronald Reagan had induced them to start building. And that was because they suddenly had a reason to want to be, you know, building engines and other parts that would go to be assembled in cars because it was lower cost. The moment that you begin to bring the assembly part of the value chain domestically, the rest of it slowly starts to follow. And so their claim that Japanese investment in production facilities in 1990s somehow sort of trumps the merits of protectionism in the 80s completely misunderstands the purpose of the policy and also the reason for that Japanese investment in the first place, which was only because they'd invested in these assembly plants thanks to Ronald Reagan's policy. So it was pretty amusing, honestly, to watch some of the responses and rebuttals I got. I responded to Scott Linsicum in National Review. He wrote a letter to the editor that I responded to, where he essentially conceded all of my core points.
I remember this now. This is specifically what I was remembering. I'm really glad that you're taking me down the lane, because I remember this actually being a pretty edifying exchange.
Yeah, I was glad that he essentially made all these concessions and just complained essentially at the end of the day about higher consumer prices. This is a trade-off. Trade-offs are a feature of economic policy, and the American people had expressed their preference, not only in the president's preferred policies, not only in this New York Times poll, but also the fact that Congress at the time was saying that if Reagan didn't act, they would also enforce an even stronger quota than Reagan was pushing for. And so, sure, according, in the cloisters of libertarian think tanks, I'm sure that Hayekian theory suggests some other approach. But in practice, I think what Ronald Reagan showed is that the interests of the American people, the political demands of the strategic sector, and the unique geoeconomic reality demanded a different course that deviated from the theories of the libertarians.
So where is there, similar to how we, the direction we went in the last sort of half of this conversation, where are these lessons maybe best applied in the economy of today? I imagine maybe you'd talk about chips again, but is there anything where you think we'd be best to, I mean, gosh, I can think of a million things, but as somebody who looks at these policies, is there a place where you think this is the lesson that should immediately be applied in this space?
Yeah, sure. So one immediately that comes to mind is batteries. Batteries are extremely important. And as we're moving increasingly towards electric vehicles, it's going to be super, super important that we develop these things and build them in the United States. So many batteries are produced in China and they get the raw materials from China. It's super important that we are not only designing these high capacity batteries in the United States, but they're also building them here and assembling them here. The Biden administration has taken this approach of sort of, demand side subsidies, right? They want to, give these massive tax write-offs for wealthy people to buy Teslas. I don't think that's the right approach. I don't think that subsidizing demand in this case is the right way of going about it. There are other policies that the Biden administration has endorsed. We'll see about the implementation that could make sense in this space. But I do think that it's a perfect angle for Republicans, especially those sort of the nationalist populist variety, to champion and say, no, look, we want to ensure that the future is not only designed here, but built here. And batteries have so many commercial applications. They're so important, and they have to be made here. Just like we think that chips should be made here, high-end cutting-edge chips, so too should batteries. I think we can say the same thing about the computers and smartphones that we use every day. I think it's ridiculous that these things are not made in the United States. I get that they're sort of cheap consumer electronic goods, but it is wild to me that we are comfortable with these products being made in China, our immediate geopolitical adversary, to not only build but assemble the computers that Americans are using every day. I think it's just wild. And so you can go down the list. There's an entire laundry list of critical sectors, not only for national security purposes, just for economic purposes, that makes sense for us to adopt this type of approach, which I should add is not super straightforward. You know, the Reagan case study is nice because I think it shows that like blunt instruments are good for blunt goods. Like just saying we want to assemble cars in the United States, therefore you can't import above this level. We could maybe apply that to other sectors. I'm not sure how well it would be received. Again, it so much depends on the details and particular circumstances. And that has to be hammered out through debate and deliberation of policymakers. But I think we should have a bit of like an all of the above approach when it comes to policies here. You can have trade rules that limit imports and create new incentives. You can have subsidies on the supply side for production of these things. You can develop a research consortia that ensure that our best private minds are working together and not trying to outcompete each other in a destructive way, but in a positive way to make sure that they're innovating. You can set up other rules to ensure that we're producing, a certain share of the value of an end good here in the United States that not only protects jobs, but ensures we have a manufacturing base. There are so many useful policies that can be used across a whole range of sectors. And I think all it takes is for American policymakers who I think have been asleep at the wheel for way too long to wake up and realize that they have a constructive role to play. That yes, in a lot of places, we do just need to get Washington out of the way. I think there's a huge deregulatory piece of this. But there are other places where policymakers play an essential role, not only funding, but setting up the broad rules, common sense rules, in which market actors play, which ensure there's not only a level playing field for competition, but also that, again, private pursuit of profit is directed, broadly speaking, in a way that also supports the national interest and the well-being of all Americans.
That's a really critical point, because it seems to me the stakes are getting higher and higher as we have new people coming into office, right? You know, some people talk about how a movement is afoot, and the new right movement is afoot. Well, it takes a long time for that to actually sort of translate into electoral gains and then policy gains. And, we are really starting to see that, but it's unproductive, or maybe even counterproductive, to just flatten one side of the argument into big government conservatives that are shepherding in socialism. It's the wolf in sheep's clothing, the Trojan horse of socialism, in order to sort of apply Band-Aids to serious modern problems and throwing out all of the lessons of the past, or on the other hand, flattening the other side to just crazy libertarians that don't care about workers and just want what's best for the wealthy and are totally bought and paid for by corporate interests. I mean, neither of those characterizations is completely accurate in every case. I'm sure it is accurate in some cases. And I'm sure, Wells, that we're sort of on the same page about erring on the side of free markets and free people, as is said. But my goodness, we have higher consumer prices now because of child labor laws. We can keep going.
And then beyond that, there are what we have to recognize is that there are national interests beyond just cheap stuff. and that there are other priorities that we should have. Growth is good. We need economic growth. We need long-term sustained economic growth. But growth for its own sake is not enough. And we as conservatives, I think, understand that there are a whole host of other considerations. Ensuring that families are strong and intact, ensuring that small businesses aren't completely crushed by the Goliaths that earn all these special privileges from Washington, ensuring that workers are treated well and have a sense not only of belonging, but of value, but also of upward mobility within their communities and the firms where they are. We understand that there's so much more than just pure profit and growth for its own sake. And I think bringing that just sort of extra layer, that little bit of texture to policymaking, well, I think serve conservatives well going forward. You're absolutely right. It's we need to understand that free markets are incredibly important. I believe deeply in American capitalism, and I want to make sure that it works for generations and generations on end. But capitalism is not just another word for the things people do together in the economy, right? to quip on Barney Frank, it is a system of economic prosperity that protects property rights and private interests, but it doesn't rule out the important role of the state in setting up the conditions and setting up the general rules that again ensure that the private pursuit of profit also serves the common good. And I think there's an important role for us to play there. And I'm looking forward to what Republicans and conservatives do in the years ahead on this score.
Controversial stuff from Wells King, Research Director over at American Compass. Wells, thank you once again for joining us on Federalist Radio Hour.
Awesome. Thanks.
The first story we talked about, you can read over at the American Conservative. The second, you can read in National Review. I highly recommend you check out both of those and follow Wells' work. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.